The plantation in America was a fundamental part of the economic engine that drove this country even long after the Civil War. The evolution of the plantation and its long shadow over American life is documented in Daniel Rood's new book, In the Shadow of the Great House, A History of the Plantation in America. We're very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Morning. Pleasure to be here.
So, Dan, what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take to do the research?
Well, I've been doing the research ever since I started graduate school in 2000, so a long time, but particularly working on this book about 6 years. What motivated me to write the book was a sense that while there's been a lot of really great books about slavery to come out in the last 5 to 10 years, there hasn't really been a book about the plantation itself as a kind of social institution and phenomenon for a really long time. And I think in a sense that kind of gets it backwards, because while there were forms of slavery before plantations really took off, plantations really transformed and kind of blew up slavery and sort of caused the transatlantic slave trade and the birth of modern notions of racism. So I thought we really have to go back and sort of understand what the plantation was and is.
And the thing about this book is, as you just said, it doesn't sort of start with slavery. It starts with the plantation model. So let's sort of zoom back a little bit and talk about what are the basic economics of what I would call a plantation network.
Network is a really good word, because one of the several characteristics that makes a plantation different than, let's say, a farm, it is intrinsically a creature of long-distance markets, of often global markets. So if you think about the first major plantations in the Americas, were sugar plantations. They were highly specialized, producing basically one kind of crop that couldn't be eaten locally, but really was focused on selling that one product to markets in Europe. Because of that, because planters, unlike small farmers, dedicated all the energies of the enslaved people who they forced to work to growing this one thing, those plantations were also very dependent on faraway places for the supplies they needed to survive. One great example of this is New England. New England's whole export economy in its early days in the mid to late 1600s is really premised on supplying the sugar plantations in the Caribbean, and some of their founders, like John Winthrop, actually kind of celebrated that and were quite aware of that. So even parts of the United States we think of as kind of outside the history of plantations are very much tied into those networks.
Okay, so the plantations were not producing much of what they needed to survive. It's almost like the model is plantation is factory, right? That it's just making this one exportable output.
Yeah, that's right. And much like factories, they're kind of monstrous consumers of the supplies, mm-hmm. and also, of course, the enslaved workers on which they depend.
And that's obviously what we're going to get to pretty quickly. But let's sort of take a step back, because most of us think of, when we hear the word plantation, we have visions of Gone with the Wind in the American South. But that's not where things start. How do they start in the Caribbean?
I start the book with this island that many of us haven't heard of called São Tomé, mm-hmm. Which the Portuguese settle. It's an island off the west coast of Africa, what is currently like around Gabon and Angola. And the Portuguese basically create like a new kind of social institution there. It's the first of the Sugar Islands, and this happens in the 1500s. And basically you have merchants there who are bringing together two very new kinds of phenomena that really augur the growth of modern capitalism. And one is this sense that because of their connections to the slave trade out of mainland Central Africa, they have what Portuguese policymakers actually called a bottomless supply of enslaved workers, of slaves. And they put those slaves to working on these sugar plantations, which again are highly specialized, and they transform the ecology of São Tomé from a highly diverse tropical ecosystem to really a large span monoculture across the island. They are focusing, again, very unlike farmers of their time who were very diversified in what they grew and produced, they're just growing sugar and that's for export to European consumers. I think sugar is really important in the birth of the modern world. Because unlike, let's say, other sort of early modern goods that got produced a lot, like wool or like grain, there are only so many pairs of wool pants a consumer can wear in a year, only so many loaves of bread they can eat. But sugar is what scholars call a drug crop. It's addictive, it's habit forming, and as we well know, there is really no ceiling on the growth that the market for a crop like this can have. And so they're bringing together these two sources of what they think of as kind of endless growth and expansion. And in that sense, the plantations really ignite a new mindset that we associate with modern capitalism.
So it's the mindset, it's the success of the model that causes people to think about bringing it over the ocean into the Caribbean?
Well, it's a two-sided process. It is, depending on your perspective, it is a fantastic short-term success in terms of the profit that the owners of the plantations make, but also it's not sustainable. They're ecologically ruinous. And the exploitation of enslaved people is so intense that a huge slave rebellion breaks out in São Tomé in 1595. And so the sugar plantation system in São Tomé ends up going into fairly steady decline. But the people who try to repeat that experiment in the Americas, they remember the profits and they sort of forget the destruction. And they want to do it all over again because the profits are just so enticing.
And we see one of the lessons that we'll talk about later, which is the importance of this risk of rebellion and the importance of security and how the operators had to come up with forms of repression to control for that.
Correct. That's always on the minds of planters and slave owners.
And I got to imagine the San Tome was a very good location because it was right on the spice trade route going to India.
Yeah, well, that's why the Portuguese discovered that.
Yeah.
But this is one of these moments where, like, there are these unintended consequences that emerge, right? Because in the medieval era, sugar had been thought of as a spice that only the wealthy of the Christian countries consumed, and they consumed it in very small amounts. What plantations in the Atlantic world do is they start to try to turn it from a spice only meant for the elites to a staple that all facets of society are able to consume on a daily basis. And it's really the sort of cheapening of the goods that comes with the plantation model that make that a possibility.
So let's move to the Caribbean. What do we start to see happening over there?
First of all, the British Empire start to take shape really around this plantation system. It's the Portuguese and Dutch who get there first. But by the mid to late 1600s, the British have sort of made, I guess you could call it a new São Tomé on the island of Barbados. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of our listeners might think about Barbados as perhaps a tourist destination, a place that a cruise ship might pass by. But in the late 1600s, Barbados is arguably the most important place in the entire British Empire. That's where the vast majority of enslaved people that British slave traders bring across the Atlantic are not going to the Carolinas, not going to New England. They're going to this small island of Barbados, which has been, observers said, cultivated from coast to coast in sugar plantations. Well, that's a bit of an exaggeration. That's largely true. And so they achieve the same kind of profits, the same kind of outsized political importance and influence as their Portuguese predecessors did on São Tomé. But also they, of course, reproduce a lot of the same problems of slave resistance, of ecological ruination, and of overcrowding. Mm-hmm. So what happens, Barbados, the profits are so kind of, fantastically seductive. I mean, it's not sustainable. And so in the 1650s, a bunch of wealthy planters urge, it's Oliver Cromwell, who is in charge in England at the time, and they urge him to sponsor a conquest of the neighboring island of Jamaica to sort of give them more room to move. And in fact, that mission happens. And in 1655, Jamaica becomes part of the British Empire. They take it from Spain. So you can already see the way it's kind of spreading its tentacles beyond the small island.
Let's move to the continental United States. And I assume that a big trigger here is going to be tobacco.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, to sort of, you know, make the transition kind of at, you know, as organic as possible, those same Barbadian planters who felt overcrowded in Barbados and wanted a bigger, more sort of room to grow, also spearhead the colonization of the Carolinas. Barbadians are sort of all over that early colonization of Carolina, and very quickly sort of import the slave code from Barbados and start to try to run that cycle again in the Carolinas. The tobacco story is really important for us because it shows that without plantations, American colonization of North America may never have happened at all. So when the first company that establishes Jamestown in 1607, they're not really thinking about setting up a permanent settler colony. Basically, they're really angry that the Spanish have found all the silver and gold in the Americas, these damn Catholics, as they thought of them. They want to basically hijack Spanish ships and take the silver and gold from them that's coming from Mexico back to Europe. So basically, they established Jamestown as a forward operating base to hijack Spanish ships. And that never really pans out. They try to find silver and gold in Virginia, and that really doesn't pan out either. They don't do a very good job of having diplomatic relationships with Powhatan's empire in Virginia. And in fact, they're almost ready to give up when they bring in tobacco seedlings or seeds from the Caribbean, it had been an indigenous crop, and bring it to Virginia. And this becomes the saving grace of the colony of Virginia because they finally have an export product that can bring profits to all the investors back in England who had funded the venture. And without that export product, it's not clear to me at all that Virginia would have grown in the way that it did.
Okay, so we sort of started to set the stage. Let's sort of jump a little bit and talk about how important was the economic engine of the plantation. If we get to the 1800s, tell us where we were seeing plantations, what they were growing, and how important it was as an economic driver.
Sure. What happens after the American Revolution is this terrifically rapid spread of the plantation system across the Deep South. And it has everything to do with the transition or the adding of cotton onto the older plantation crops of rice and tobacco. And so there is this process of piecemeal conquest of Native American lands from the Creek and the Cherokee, who were very numerous and powerful in the South, and the very quick establishment of new states like Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi. And then again, very quickly, even though there's this kind of Jeffersonian ideal that we would make a great country by populating these areas with small farmers, very quickly, wealthy plantation owners take a sort of monopolize a lot of the good lands and take control of the political systems of those states and kind of create, in some ways, a mirror image of what their predecessors had done on the East Coast. And so that means by the 1850s, so we think about the United States sort of in the middle of the 1800s as this kind of growing new emerging economic juggernaut of sort of continental span with this really rapidly growing population and a very diversified economy, at least in the northern states. And yet, even in spite of all of that economic power and all that export power, cotton alone is over half of total U.S. exports in the 1850s.
Yeah, I want to go back because you mentioned Georgia. And when you read a book like this, certain things leap out at you. A lot of tragedy in this book. But one of the ones that really bothered me was the way that Georgia evolved. Can you talk a little bit about how the model in Georgia changed?
I'd love to. So Georgia is established as a colony quite late in colonial history, not until 1732. And it's basically the philanthropic project of a British man named James Oglethorpe, who wants to establish a place for the kind of poor and trodden upon and misled masses of Britain, of the British cities, which he sees as sort of dens of vice and sin and misbehavior. He wants to establish Georgia as a place where they can kind of like find God again, find the right path, and have a bit of a better material life. And so what Oglethorpe does when Georgia is established as a colony, he's looking at South Carolina, a place that is already dominated by rice-planting slave owners, and there's the majority of South Carolina's population is African or African-descended. He wants Georgia to be the anti-South Carolina. So he makes slavery illegal, and he makes large land holdings illegal. So those are the two main aspects of the plantation. Sure. And so he's very clearly trying to set a policy that will make that kind of emergence impossible. But there are these sort of middle-class settlers who end up becoming called the malcontents, who are incensed about this. And they think that Georgia should be free. And when they think about freedom, they think about their right as white men, that's how they call themselves, to own and control, quote-unquote, Negro slaves. They even say, we have, quote, not the liberty of getting Negroes. And that language, where they are sort of basing their own freedoms, their own sense of their own rights on the right to control black people legally and in a daily way, I think, you know, sets a pattern in American politics and culture that we still see now. And what they end up sort of winning the day. Oglethorpe eventually leaves in 1751. The governing authorities in Georgia overturn those laws against both slaveholding and large land holdings. And in 1751, all of these planters from South Carolina, feeling overcrowded, cross the Savannah River into Georgia and start to make these large rice plantations in Georgia, which means by 1776, Georgia has indeed, Low Country Georgia has indeed become a sort of mirror of Low Country South Carolina. And what that means is when we go into the American Revolution, we now have not just one state, but a deep South region that is deeply and fully committed to enslavement as the centerpiece of their society and economy.
Yeah. Okay. So let's jump 100 years later into the antebellum's era. You know, Gone with the Wind notwithstanding, what was life like for slaves at the time?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I'd say two, it's a long story. I've studied this for a long time, but I would say there's sort of two main ways to talk about it. One is to talk about something called the chattel principle. The chattel principle basically means that in legal terms, in any state of the United States where slavery is legal, enslaved people are treated as movable property like any other. That's called chattel. There was a man who was born in slavery named James Pennington, who escaped from slavery and ended up writing a book about his experience in slavery. He called it The Fugitive Blacksmith, which is one of my favorite titles of all time. And he says, the soul of slavery lives and moves in the chattel principle. What he's saying is that it really doesn't matter if you can come up with examples of, oh, this slave owner treated their slaves really well, and this slave owner treated his or her slaves like family. Because what lies underneath that is the fact that that person, no matter how they're treated, always has an invisible price tag hanging over their head, that the enslaver can make good by turning them into money at any time. And that means their lives, no matter what the material realities of their lives were very much at the mercy of this person who enslaved them and the market that controlled them. So the second thing that I would say is enslaved people in the antebellum South, life could be quite diverse. You do have urban slavery where people are blacksmiths and barbers and carpenters and skilled laborers who are sometimes working for wages, and they have to deliver those wages over to the person who owns them. But the vast majority of enslaved people do live on small to medium-sized plantations, and they are growing cotton. And I would say it's a life of unremitting drudgery.
Yeah, so taking the humanity out of it. So they were trade all assets at any time. You have a plantation owner needed money. He could just break up a family and get some money on a sale.
Yeah, that's right. You have these heartbreaking stories of slave owners who had gambling problems, and they would make good their debts by breaking up the communities of enslaved people that they owned. There's a story that I talk about in the book of a man who is interviewed in the 1930s. This is this great New Deal program called the Works Progress Administration, where they go south and all of these writers interview all of the surviving people who'd been born into slavery. And so it's a fantastic set of resources. And I found this one story of a man who, when he was a boy, I think he was 10, he was sold because the slave owner's daughter needed a wedding dress. So it's like her family is being made through the destruction of his family. Man. And in such a boldly clear and shameless way.
If my favorite story in the book was about Georgia, my favorite chapter title was Bottom Rail on the Top This Time. What was that referring to?
Oh man, this is such a great story. It's the story of how during the Civil War, hundreds of thousands of people in slavery escaped their owners during the war and fled to Union lines to pursue freedom. The Lincoln administration sort of hemmed and hawed for a while about what to quote unquote do with these people. But Lincoln ends up making the very strategically smart decision of mustering the men into the armed forces. And about a little under 200,000 African Americans, the vast majority of them who had grown up as slaves, actually serve in the Union Army and or the Union Navy. So there's this one Union soldier who had escaped his owner during the war. He gets mustered into the Union troops. He's wearing the blue uniform and carrying a musket. All of that is just absolutely terrifying, apocalyptic world upside down to slave owners. And at the end of the war, when the Confederacy has surrendered, he is guarding a group of Confederate troops, and he sees his former master there. And of course, their positions have been totally reversed. He's now a prisoner. And the former slave is guarding him, is an armed guard over him. And apparently an observer heard him call out and say, something, I don't remember the exact quote, but something like, hey, master, isn't this funny? Bottom rail on top this time. And that meant that the social order had been flipped upside down by the war itself.
Now, what happened to the plantation structure during the Reconstruction period?
Well, for a brief and fascinating moment, it's really taken apart. Sherman, after his march, basically said that this war will never fully be over until we crush these planters who, would rather die a thousand deaths than work with their own hands. And so he, knowing that, and also seeing that there are hundreds of thousands of black refugees from this disintegrating plantation system, decides that it's a good idea, and I agree with him, to settle formerly enslaved people on the plantations where they used to be enslaved, but as small landowners, as small farmers. And hundreds of thousands of acres in 1865 and 66 are turned over to formerly enslaved people, who get access to their own farms and start sort of resettling these kind of abandoned landscapes and carving out new lives for themselves as free people. Unfortunately, Lincoln is assassinated. Andrew Johnson, who takes his place, is much more sympathetic to ex-Confederates. And he appoints new people throughout his administration who basically reverse all of that. They pardon ex-Confederate planters very quickly and quote unquote give them their lands back. And a lot of people end up being evicted from their farms and become basically landless. And the plantation, under new terms of sharecropping, is allowed to kind of take on a second life after slavery.
And then they are pretty much enslaved still because they're not getting paid decent wages.
Well, no, I think so. That's fair. That's a fair question. But I think, oddly, sharecropping is actually something that planters did not want. Planters, when they got their lands back, they tried very hard to recreate as precisely as they could the system they had run before the Civil War. But the Union government is still occupying the South and is forcing them to sign contracts with ex-slaves and to pay them cash wages, okay? But so they could have, if they had had money, they could have just kept the same system of sort of gang labor under white overseers and sort of large masses of workers working their days away under white supervision if they'd had cash to pay wages, but they didn't have any money and their Confederate dollars were worthless. What the formerly enslaved people wanted, of course, was their own farms. But if they couldn't have that, what they wanted most was daily freedom from white supervision. So basically, sharecropping emerges as a kind of grudging compromise between both groups. Ex-slaves wanted land. That was taken away from them. Ex-enslavers wanted slavery again. They couldn't have that. So they end up coming up with the sharecropping system where basically formerly enslaved families become kind of tenants, paying half of their crop to planters, to landowners. But they do have a lot more daily freedoms than they had under slavery. So they do amazing things. Like if you ever look at sort of small, like black church congregations in the South, it's so frequent to see, you know, established 1868, established 1871. They are making an entire new society that had been happening in a secret underground way under slavery. They're bringing that out to the light of day, and it's a fantastic moment of freedom.
But were they indeed free as sharecroppers? Mm-hmm. Weren't they kind of stuck to that land?
It really depends where you are. So in a place like the Mississippi Delta, which really becomes kind of ground zero of this big cotton boom that happens actually in the late 1800s, the United States produces three times as much cotton as it had produced right before the Civil War. And they dedicate, I think, almost four times as much acreage to cotton as they had before the Civil War. In other words, cotton is even more important to Southern society than it had been during the era of so-called King Cotton. In the Delta, almost all the plantation workers are black, and almost all of the plantation workers are sharecroppers. Sharecropper is a very specific thing. A sharecropper means not only do you have no land, you have no work animals of your own, you have no tools of your own, you have no seed of your own. So you're dependent on the landowner for all of your inputs. And in the Delta, the landowners there succeeded in like placing a new kind of daily authority over black sharecroppers. Mm-hmm. However, I took a close look at census records in the older parts of the South, like Georgia and Alabama. In Georgia, sharecroppers are actually only one category of black farmers who are in some kind of tenancy. But there are other kinds of renters who have a lot more power and autonomy than sharecroppers did. And I talk about this, the majority of black tenants in Georgia are actually, they're called standing renters. And what that meant is they did own their own animals. They did have some independent wealth. They owned more land, and they had a lot more autonomy and freedom than their sharecropping neighbors closer to the Mississippi. So in Georgia and Alabama, even in the depths of Jim Crow, planters have not succeeded in reestablishing daily control over the descendants of enslaved people. And there is a kind of space, like small spaces of freedom and subsistence that I think historians have ignored in the Jim Crow South that we need to pay more attention to.
Good. So now moving on, 20th century, the South went from cotton to poultry. Why did that happen?
The South goes from cotton to poultry for two reasons. One is the boll weevil, which was a pest that decimated cotton crops throughout the South. And the other is the Great Depression, of course, which caused cotton prices to crater and made it so that everyone who was depending on cotton across the South, let's take Georgia in particular. So you have small white farmers, you have large white landowners, you have small black farmers, and you have black sharecroppers and tenants. None of them can continue to exist just focusing on cotton. millions of people, both black and white, who had been caught up in the sharecropping system. So it's important to point out that there were a lot of white sharecroppers in the South as well, most of whom were the descendants of non-wealthy whites from before the Civil War. And so everybody is looking for an alternative to cotton monoculture. And in North Georgia in particular, they move from cotton to raising chickens. And they are raising chickens sort of on contract, where the birds are delivered to them by a poultry processing company who also give them the feed, sell them the houses, sell them all of the equipment, have them raise the birds, and then they deliver the birds to the processing company. The processing company processes those birds and sells them in ever-increasing numbers to the American populace. The reason that system of cheap, sort of mass-produced poultry emerges where it does is precisely because of the failures of the plantation system. So most of the people who are in this exploitative relationship with these poultry processing companies that become more and more powerful in the 50s and in the 60s, most of them had been cotton farmers, and farming chicks instead was a way they could hold on to their land. But they're in very exploitative relationships. They don't make a lot of money out of this, and a lot of them end up concluding it's a new form of sharecropping. It's their desperation from the failures of the plantation economy to serve their long-term interests that forced them into that situation. The big workforce working on the killing floor of these poultry houses in the 50s, 60s, and 70s are black women, who also are refugees from the failures of the plantation system. So in both those ways, the sort of failure of the plantation also kind of gives birth to cheap meat in America.
Last questions before we go, Dan. To what extent do we see remnants of the plantation economy here in the U.S. and in South America?
I think that we see much more than remnants. I think we see a continuing dependence on this model of the plantation, of using cheap, rightless labor, of sort of swallowing large swaths of the environment to make short-term profits. So the biggest sugar planters in the world right now are big oil conglomerates like British Petroleum, who are huge landowners in Brazil. And they have been part of a big sugar boom in Brazil to produce ethanol, to produce alternative fuels. A lot of that has been exported to Europe and elsewhere around the world. But now with the advent of artificial intelligence, it's sort of all hands on deck for the capitalist world to produce as much energy as it possibly can. And in that way, plantations, which are still exploiting migrant workers in Brazil in very intense ways, and turning Brazilian countryside areas over to a new kind of sugar plantation monoculture, are very much trying to invest in this energy source to be on the cutting edge of the artificial intelligence revolution. So the plantation is still at the center in many ways.
The book is In the Shadow of the Great House, A History of the Plantation in America. Professor Daniel Rude, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
All right. We'll be right back after this.